Welcome back to Inside Public Accounting. I'm your host, Rob Brown. And handling the interview today, Chelsea Summers, my co-host, is taking a day off. Today, we're diving into one of the most important questions facing firm leaders right now. How do you create enterprise value without giving up independence? Our guest today is the prestigious Brian Blaha of Winding River Consulting. Brian works with accounting firm leaders across the world, particularly North America, on strategy, growth, governance, long-term value creation. Brian, welcome to Inside Public Accounting.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here. It's fun. I'm looking forward to the discussion today.
Well, this is certainly your heritage, Brian. You've made a name in this area. Private equity investment, obviously reshaping the profession. What kind of shape do you feel the accounting profession is in right now?
You know, I think it's a really exciting time to be in the profession, honestly. You know, you can be a little bit of dauntingness going on to some extent, right? It's like there's all of these different pressures going on with private equity changing just the speed, frankly, of which things are happening in the profession. But then there's technology transformation and organizational and governance changes and all the things. But all in all, it's a fun time to be in the profession. I think the outlook should be bright. And, you know, I'm looking forward to kind of diving into all those specifics.
Yeah, you can see your eyes light up at just the thought of debating some of the things. Chelsea and I have talked about private equity a lot on the show because Inside Public Accounting, he's very good at having the data and the stories behind the numbers. And I know you're a fan of the show, Brian. That's great to know. But clearly many firms are feeling pressure to make a decision, take outside capital or risk falling behind. It's tough to compete with these firms that are backed. I know you and Gary Sheamus, David Toth at Winding River, you're very much advocates of independence where it's possible. Your message is a little bit different from what I've seen of what you've said and written, Brian. Generating enterprise value isn't about selling, it's creating optionality. Just talk us through what that means.
Yeah, I don't know if I coined it, but I've been using this term strategic optionality out in the marketplace. And to me, that means that there's things that you should be doing that you can create and maintain the ability to run your firms from, you know, independent stature and have, you know, options out in the future for whatever track that may look like. And, you know, when we start to peel back the onion on that term, a lot of it, you know, because you always hear like, oh, we can't compete with private equity. And if you really dive into their playbook, it's like you start to ask yourself the question, well, if they can do it, why can't we? Why can't the leaders of the firms do it as well? And the fact of the matter is they can. And it requires a sense of discipline. And, you know, I was talking with a leader of one of the large private equity platforms roll up that's out there. And we started to dive into a model that I've helped firms work through. And, you know, the question was, well, you know, it doesn't work to stay independent. I'm like, well, that's not what I'm seeing in the data and the information. And we got all the way through the model and the conversation turned to, well, the leaders just don't have the discipline that we do as private equity leaders. And to me, that almost was a little bit of a step back. It was like, well, you know, that's how they're viewing it to some extent. And it's like going, well, okay, well, us at Winding River, how do we help the firm leaders create and feel confident in the discipline that they're going to need to run the firm in a very similar way that the private equity firms are doing? So at the end of the day, what are they doing? They're helping the firms run themselves as businesses in a more, you know, strategic and, you know, a more strategic way.
Yeah. Discipline's an interesting word. We'll come back to that. Another word that comes up a lot is urgency. Independent firms competing in a PE-driven environment. There's a payoff, isn't there? A tension, if you like, between bringing money out of the firm now and creating enterprise value long term. So I suppose the big picture, private equity is driving this sense of urgency, isn't it, Brian, within firms? From your vantage point, what are firm leaders most anxious about right now? What is this urgency bringing about?
Yeah, there's three main items that firm leaders are really wrestling with right now. The first one really is being driven by the private equity side, and that's just ownership and governance related to, you know, they're getting pressure from, they get calls every day, right, from the private equity firms. They're getting questions from their partners, they're getting questions from the associates in the firm, like what's the strategic direction of the firm? So that's a huge one that firm leaders are just dealing with, and I know it's weighing on them. The second one is technology and AI. You know, that's a whole nother thread show that we can go down for a future time probably. But as we get into enterprise value, that's the creation of what technology and frankly the influence of AI is going to have on the firm. So those are the two huge ones. But then the third one I throw in there is just talent and leadership. And it's really an outcome of the first two in a lot of ways. You know, those three in, you know, all TVB podcasts, you know, in and of themselves, but those are the things I know that are just weighing on firm leaders today.
And it does create a phrase I've used a lot in my own podcast, Accounting Voices, is leadership under pressure. You've been in this game a long time, Brian. Would you say it's harder being a leader now than it was 20, 30 years ago?
Probably in many ways, but I think that the profession has evolved to, you know, where the partners are maybe finally realizing that it's, you know, hey, to be a partner today isn't the same what it was years ago, right? It's like firm governance structures are more prevalent. I think people understand them. They understand that you need, you know, board of directors and that you have a C-suite that actually runs the firm on a day-to-day basis. I think when you see firms that still have all their partners around the table trying to make a decision, those firms are going to have a rude awakening in many cases. But the firms that can say, okay, separate the role that you play on your day-to-day and the title of what your ownership is in the firm and put different hats on, you know, based on, you know, what the conversation is of the day. And for the most part, most partners and firms that are operating in the business have their owner hat on only a few times a year, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it is a mindset shift that just needs to occur in the firms. But once you're able to make that leap, then being able to run your business as a business, I think, you know, with the support of a aligned partner group, you know, is in a better spot than where we were a decade or two decades ago.
I interviewed Mark Koziel, who now heads up the AICPA, on a stage in London a few years ago, and he said the partner model is broken because partners cannot be managed. They've all got so many different agendas, and he pointed to the C-suite model. So I totally get you on that. A common misunderstanding, Brian, seems to be that enterprise value is the same as selling. I mean, those are synonymous. You wouldn't agree with that, would you?
No, you know, The way that I've been thinking about it is that, you know, especially if you are trying to be a platform, you're not really selling your firm to private equity. You're actually taking an investment, you know, in changing your capital stack or capital structure. So there's this misnomer that, hey, I'm going to sell my firm to private equity. Well, in reality, especially if you're the platform, your job doesn't change the day after you take the equity. In fact, they're investing in you into the leadership team of the firm. And frankly, the strategy that you have developed, and you're operating your firm now with a different stakeholder. And, you know, I was at the PE Summit back in November, Accounting Today's PE Summit, and two of the private equity firm leaders had the same phrase, and it stuck with me. I've been using it in some of my consulting work, is that the PE transaction is a one-time unlock of value.
Ooh.
And that really struck me, right? And it was repeated multiple times. And because when you think about it, firms have undervalued themselves largely, although we can come back to that. And what the transaction does is essentially levels up to the value that the firms are at today. But in essence, you've then shifted the value creation now to a new stakeholder, you know, obviously dependent on the amount of the percent of equity that you sell, you know, to the private equity firm. So it is an interesting dynamic, you know, because all that future value creation is then attributed to, in large account, to the new ownership group.
Yeah. We hear the term, the fight for independence. We have it here in the UK with Scotland and Ireland and Wales and the United Kingdom and Britain being a part of Europe or not. And when we use terms like fighting and war, independence with accounting firms doesn't seem to be a viable long-term strategy because it is a struggle. There are a lot of pressure. Tell us exactly what it takes to be independent today.
Yeah, well, I always start out with the concept of, do you understand what your North Star is? Do you understand what your why is for the firm? And frankly, most firm owners can't answer that.
They don't. They've not designed it intentionally, Brian, a lot of the time.
Right. Yeah, right. And it's just, we're here to serve clients and they don't really have a direction for the firm. So if you're going to say you're going to stay independent, in many ways, that term has a little bit of a, you know, negative connotation in many ways because it's similar to status quo, you know. And I think firm leaders need to reshift that. And that's why this term strategic optionality has been interesting for me to use, because I can use it in place of the term independence. And then it's like, okay, what would it take to maintain your strategic optionality versus what would it take to be independent? And those are two different directions that you could go. So then when you look at it and say, well, what are the things that you have to do if you're going to maintain your strategic optionality, or I guess you could say to stay independent, it's a whole litany of things, right? And that's going to be, how do I grow in a cohesive way? What's my go-to-market strategy, my North Star and vision? Do I have capital discipline? Do I take some of the chips off the table every year and reinvest them back in the business versus, you know, redistributing all of our earnings out to the partners, which is a huge break that you have to think about. I'd love to talk a little bit more about that. Can you scale your infrastructure as the firm grows? And you know, ultimately, what's your capital strategy? And I think the misnomer is that you can't fund your own growth. But when you think about it, you know, like we're working with a couple of firms on evaluating ESOPs. And, you know, that's another vehicle that firms are using to essentially maintain strategic optionality or stay independent. But that model is, you know, you take on debt to redistribute the shares of the firm into a different ownership structure. Well, the traditional CPA firm has not utilized debt in that way, but the private equity firms are. So it's a difference in risk tolerance and what the private equity firms, how they're using their balance sheet. And there's nothing to say that an independent firm can't use their balance sheet in that way, which potentially can take up some of the pressure that you mentioned before.
We know many of you listen to this podcast on the go, driving to work, working out, even doing chores. Now you can get CPE credit for that time. With Earmark, you can earn free NASBA-approved CPE for listening to the Inside Public Accounting podcast. After you listen to an episode, take a quiz, and your certificate will be ready. Earmark has courses for everyone in your firm, from staff to partners. Get started today at earmark.app or download the free app on the App Store.
When you say strategic optionality, it sounds like you're building your own dictionary, your own doxology, Brian. But it's right. We do need to change the terms of reference here because the game is changing. Those firms that choose not to take PE money, are they at any structural disadvantages?
You know, that's an interesting question, because when you think about what is happening is the private equity firm is bringing structure to the organization in many ways. And, you know, they're bringing outside advisory board members. They're bringing the discipline, financial modeling. I mean, everything is about the model at the end of the day inside those firms. You know, it's all about EBITDA creation and what the multiple is and what that value move is and what the turn is going to look like, you know, the investable return for their shareholders. And when you look at the private firm, those things largely don't exist. And so the disadvantage is that they haven't put the time and energy to create those things. But can they? Absolutely. You know, we are seeing a trend of independent firms start to bring on outside advisory board members, which I think is a really healthy. I know Gary's talked about it a lot. He's on the board of a number of firms. I actually just announced that I'm on the board of one firm as well. And it's that type of advice, you know, bringing on that type of external to help the leaders think through what some of this, you know, structure needs to look like inside the firm. And then they can then operate their firm in a model that's more similar to what the PE firms are operating in.
A couple of areas of potential disadvantage came to my mind in the areas of talent and tech, because both need investment. If you want to stay ahead with your tech stack, you've got to invest a lot in that, and you've got to invest in talent. You've got to pay competitively. You've got to put a value proposition in place for your employees that stands apart in a very competitive marketplace. And private equity money gives you that.
Yes and no, right? Because the initial transaction, you know, largely goes to pay the current owners, right? And yeah. redistribute the capital stack. So largely right. what those firms are doing, not entirely, but it's in either one or two ways. They're bringing additional capital to the table, which further dilutes the owners, or they're leveraging their balance sheet with debt to invest in those type of things. So yeah. if you just take a step back and say, you know, well, okay, well, if that's what they're doing, why can't we do that as an independent firm? And the answer to that is, you can't. I mean, I'll say in my history, you know, the firm I was with, we made a ton of investments over the years. You know, we did 40 acquisitions. We, you know, invested in all the same tech stack that everybody else was investing in. Well, where did that money come from? Well, it came out of partner distributions.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just, we just did it because that was what was right for the business. One of my clients has we've been saying in the boardroom is, you know, he has a saying is, want to make sure that the partner group is looking at the firm with the future, you know, intact, and that we're making good business decisions for the business, for the firm, right? It's not just about the individual partners. So I'm not of the belief that you can't make those same investments just because you don't have private equity capital. I think it just takes the firm to challenge themselves to operate in a different way, which means that they have to operate similarly and scrape their partners' earnings and reinvest those earnings into the firm. But partners aren't necessarily going to give that up if they don't balance the equation. And so that requires them to relook at their deferred comp models and readjust what those look like. So if you're going to take money off the table and reinvest, then the partners should feel like they're getting a higher return, you know, when it's time to liquidate that investment, either at retirement or through some other vehicle.
Yeah, well said. What about managing partners that are very vehement and they're very emotionally attached to the firm? Obviously, they built it, they owned it, they've got equity in it, but they say, well, not for sale. And they take a strong stance and they're bored, their senior partners go with them, but they've got to be doing things today and tomorrow to prove that that's a strategic decision and not just an emotional
one. And so when we're working with firms and they come to us and say, hey, we're not for sale, what do we do? You know, yes. which I think is really the question here, right? And it's like, we always start out with, well, what's your North Star? What's your why? Let's get that down on paper, because it's hard to know where you're going. It's hard to say we're not for sale without having, you know, a strong firm strategy on what that's going to look like, or at least where you're headed, because we can fill in the strategy. But then I think you got to look at, well, let's redefine the model that you're operating under. So meaning like, well, what is the structure that we're operating under? Do we have the right governance? And then ultimately, do we have the right, you know, organizational structure and firm model to actually facilitate that new way of being? So we can compete, you know, with, because everyone will say, well, we can't compete. We can't, in a merger and acquisition scenario, we don't have the cash. Well, okay, well, if we redesign the firm, we retain some capital, build our balance sheet, now we can do that. But we start out and actually model that out. So there gives the leaders confidence that they actually can do that. So it's one thing to say it in the boardroom, but it's another thing to present actual data. And one thing I found is that firms really have not spent the time to actually model out, you know, what their deferred comp program looks like. What does their forecast look like? Even if it's a 5-year, 10-year, we'll actually go out 20 years just, you know, with a terminal type of assumptions, just so that they can see that the cash flow does work. And then we start making some business decisions around that. And then along with it, modernize their governance structure. So if they don't have, you know, a board, or they are underdeveloped in their C-suite. Well, let's add those elements. So then we're on a strong foundation that then we can do the other things that are truly going to create enterprise value for the firm.
You've got an accounting background. I am a part qualified accountant, but I'm a former high school math teacher. So do you remember in mathematics, you had the Venn diagram, the overlapping circles?
Yep.
And so this question, the strategic plan, the strategic optionality, are they overlapping circles? Are they the same thing? Do they absorb one another? Just unpack that for us, Brian.
I do believe that they are. I mean, the strategic plan is helping the firm with direction. And so we've got that North Star out there. I like to talk about strategy and horizon. So it's, you know, horizon one is kind of your 1 year plan. Horizon two is your 3 to 5 years. So it's the things that you can start to throw the ball down the court and actually achieve. And then horizon three are those things that you're starting to move the firm, you know, past that you don't have the tangible thing, but you know where you want to go. So much more directional orientation and horizon, where I think of strategic optionality is kind of the structure that makes all that happen. So definitely overlapping and necessary, but kind of two different things. And a lot of times the strategic elements to help you maintain that optionality are all baked into the strategic plan. So there's definitely some things there that are overlapping and very similar.
So Brian, this is a conversation that many firms need to hear right now. We're going to bring you back for another episode and digest this a little bit more, because I've got so many questions that I'd love to ask you. But let's finish with this one for the moment. Let's give some hope and some practical advice to these firms. Chelsea and I always like to do this. We're very pragmatic. What characteristics define a firm that truly has optionality? Because we're starting to give them a roadmap or give them a checklist or a playbook or things to think about. And they need to know if they've got the governance model, leadership bench depth, the capital structure, the partner alignment, the revenue mix. Just talk us through some of these and finish well for us here.
All right. Sounds good, Rob. So obviously my short answer to that is yes, all of those things, right? And all I know that's all of those things, but it's a heavy weight on the managing partner in a lot of ways, right? Because they're the ones that have to drive all of those things that you just mentioned, you know, when you think about it. And a lot of times these firms, especially in the category that, you know, that is core to your audience, right? It's like, we got to figure out our go-to-market execution. And there's so much to dive into there with who's our ideal client profile and what's our target market and what niches should we go after. I like to talk in terms of Legos. So what are the strategic building blocks that you have for the firm that can drive that North Star? And then ultimately, once you start to be a master builder with those Legos, a lot of this other stuff tends to kind of fall into place. You know, so it's looking at your revenue streams, where can we lean into all of those type of things. But then it's also about looking at your, you know, your gross margin and understanding what's the building blocks of your EBITDA calculation is. I think that's a lot of times not as understood or dealt with, you know, by the firm leaders in many ways. But it's like, what does your talent model need to look like? You know, that's going to even become, you know, even more pressing in the coming days with AI and what that's going to look like. So we can talk more about that later. Technology investment, you know, and also the change management that goes along with that. It's like, don't forget about that. It's a huge part of the thing. And I think that firm leaders probably underinvest in the change management. They do a great job of saying, hey, let's implement technology and then forget about the change management. So super important part of the playbook. Distributed leadership, you know, I think I'm really diving in with firms right now on, well, what does my leadership structure need to look like?
Yeah.
And firms at these different breakpoints are like, it's time to add the COO or the CIO or the human resource leader and so forth. So that's a super critical part of the roadmap. And then it becomes all those things that we talked about, governance, you know, the infrastructure, the capital discipline. And maybe that's where to end really is discipline. Just encourage your listeners to grab the bull by the horn, frankly, and kind of have some confidence that you can do this. And just surround yourself with the folks that, so it doesn't feel like you're doing it alone.
that's a beautiful way to finish. You started on discipline and you end on discipline there. I love the way you did that. The message coming over clearly, Brian, here is that staying independent is doable for accounting firms. It is a fight, but it's ultimately a choice. And I'm reminded of the quote by Harvey McKay, who wrote Swim with the Sharks, and he said, dig your well before you're thirsty. And you've got to get ahead of this. It's been a blessing to hear your perspective, your passion, your insights today, Brian. We're going to have you back for another episode and go into this a lot more. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob. I look forward to the next conversation.
Well, part two coming up. This is the Inside Public Accounting Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with colleague Taggers or Brian on LinkedIn and subscribe to the show. We're on YouTube as well. And we'll see you next time with Brian Blaha on Inside Public Accounting.